The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his six decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, this is Jeanette Garcia and I am here with Louis Ress on episode 17, Last Words, of our podcast, Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales. Louis, we've spoke briefly before about super lawyers. Did you ever have a trial involving one?
I did, yes. I've had a number. But this one was really unusual. Mm-hmm. And I entitled the story Last Words because it involved the last words of a young man who died at the scene of an auto accident. Mm. There were all kinds of accident cases running through our office. One of the most unusual ones involved four teenagers on Miami Beach who went out one night to have some thrills, skiing with a Chevy Corsair. That's the little car with the motor in the back.
And what, okay, can you tell us what skiing is?
Yes, skiing is, and I describe it later in the story, they run down, they take the car and go rapidly down a long straightaway. At the end of the straightaway is a mound, a bump, mm-hmm. like a little bridge. And they go up the bridge and take off in the air, and the car flies. You've seen it on television on
yeah.
the Daredevils.
Mm-hmm.
Gets air, they jump over other cars. This jumps out, and then the car lands, and then there's a U-turn. And the end of the road makes a U-turn, and they mm-hmm. got to turn around and, mm-hmm. and skid around and face the other way. Mm. And the kids were doing this, the teenagers were doing this yeah. for thrills. It was a thrill thing.
Huh.
So I represented, what happened was, I represented two of the passengers in the back seat. They were young high school girls, Gloria and Alice Berman. Mm. One wound up with a fractured pelvis, and the other wound up with some plastic surgery on a small scar on her arm. Hmm. And the parents called me in to represent them. One of the man-made islands on the bay side of Miami Beach had a long straightaway. At the end of about a quarter of a mile, there's this hump bridge, after which there's a sharp left turn, almost a U-turn. And the sport was to drive down the straightaway as fast as the car would go, run up the bridge and fly into the air, ski jumping the car, and then landing and recovering in time to make the left turn. Well, this crash occurred about 10 o'clock at night. The car jumped the bridge, but failed to negotiate the turn and slammed into a telephone pole on the side of the road. The car hit sideways, was skidding sideways, and was almost split in two.
Oh.
The driver, John Fine, was a 16-year-old son of a prominent Miami Beach attorney.
Oh.
The young man in the front right seat, Paul Austin, died at the scene. His family had selected a flamboyant super lawyer to represent them. His name was T.J. Rance. You bet I changed the name, but it's pretty similar, and the lawyers who hear this, who know Miami, will know who I'm talking about.
Mm.
Anyhow, the defense was that the passengers knew just what they were doing. They consented to it. They knew the risks of jumping the bridge, and they assumed those risks. They knew about the sharp left turn. They had all equally and willingly participated. They can't now complain that the driver was negligent because they admitted that they had done this before, though successfully and with a different driver, but they knew just what they were getting into.
Right.
And they knew it was risky. The car involving, the case involving the estate of Paul Austin, the young man who was in the front passenger seat and who died, was called to trial first. I was not representing him.
Mm-hmm.
He was being represented by this famous lawyer.
Right.
I had filed a separate lawsuit for Gloria and Alice, my girls, and my clients, the girls' parents, were very anxious to get their cases settled. They had medical and hospital bills with portions not covered by insurance. They didn't want their daughters to go through the tension of a trial. Both cases were being defended by the senior partner of a large defense firm located on an entire floor in a high-rise office building just next to the courthouse. His name was Otis Walker. That's close enough, I want to tell you. He was a tough, lanky, laconic, nasty sourpuss. And to make matters worse, the driver's father had brought in Murray Smith, and that's another change of name, but everyone will know Murray. the famous plaintiff's trial lawyer, who was now also aggressively defending the young driver.
Hmm.
Nobody would even talk to me. I knew that if TJ won his case, I would probably be able to settle mine. If I could help him, it would help us. So I had an idea. TJ Rance was a known alcoholic and a wife beater.
Oh.
He agreed to speak.
What a guy.
He finally agreed to speak to me at his office, but he only had a few minutes for me. He was stocky, blue-gray eyes, had sort of a longish dirty blonde hair, and he was wearing a light tan suit with a striped tie and a white shirt with cufflinks. He didn't look at me while I attempted to talk. In fact, before I could open my mouth, he told me he didn't need my suggestions, any of them, and he didn't want me telling him how to try a case. He had tried hundreds of cases like this, and who was I to suggest how the case should be tried? He rose and escorted me to the door. He was not nice to me.
Yeah.
Otis Walker had me walking behind him and from the courthouse down Flagler Street towards his office. The faster I walked to keep up with him, the faster this 6'4" beanstalk of a man kept walking faster to keep me behind. He was snarling, and he was very abrupt, and he told me there was no reason for them to settle, that they weren't offering one penny, and he would see me in court. I was so nasty, I was convinced that he and his firm represented the Ku Klux Klan. And Murray Smith wouldn't take my calls, even though I knew him from my first days in Miami, and I had interviewed for a job with him, which he didn't give me. But he was a very famous lawyer. TJ, the super lawyer, didn't even nod to me in the courtroom. He tried a nondescript case. He showed blow-ups of the car and the crash scene. He put on an expert to testify as to the speed of the car before it went over the bridge. He argued that the car went out of control because of the negligence of the driver. He brought in the county medical examiner to establish the cause and time of death. He talked about his client's pain and suffering since Paul died about a half hour after the accident. So he was alive for a half hour and had pain and suffering.
Oh, my gosh.
Otis Walker, he was wearing a gray three-piece suit, and he strode arrogantly in front of the jury, and he pounced on TJ's experts, and he picked away at TJ's case. My girls were called to testify that they had all agreed to jump the bridge. They knew it was dangerous, and they had done it before. After that, the cocky driver, John Fine, testified about the conversation before they went out to jump the bridge, namely that they all agreed to do it. The jury was out for less than an hour. We fined for the defendant. Wow. Now there was no hope of any settlement. My client's father, Mr. Berman, was concerned about the cost of the trial, including witness fees due the doctors and our accident reconstruction expert. We would have a new jury, but the same witnesses would testify. Especially damaging was the fine boy, who had been very carefully coached by Otis Walker and by Murray Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an air of smugness to this kid, and he didn't seem at all concerned that he had killed one young man and wounded two nice young girls. He wasn't concerned at all.
Ugh.
We had no choice. I told Mr. Berman, my client, that if we lost, he would never see a medical or other expert witness bill, so he had very little at risk. I told him I would pay the bills for him.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a choice. I'm responsible for them anyhow.
Huh.
So the medical bills weren't that much, and I told him I wanted to try. I had no choice to try the case.
Mm.
Mr. and Mrs. Austin, who were the parents of the kid that was killed, were sitting in the back of the courtroom. They had learned that their son had some last words with one of my young girls, and they asked if I would tell them what they were. I didn't know, but I would find out. We picked a jury, and as you may know, the case is often tried by making statements and designing questions to the proposed jurors that really explain your side of the case and influence them. Some of my questions concerned whether each juror had a valid, unrestricted driver's license. One of the jurors was a pilot, so I asked him to describe the necessary training and required experience before one was allowed to fly a passenger plane, particularly at night.
Mm-hmm.
Our case pretty much paralyzed the Austin trial. The reconstruction expert testified as to the way the accident happened, how the car skidded, and the impact. I asked why there was no accident when cars had jumped the bridge in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was that it would depend on the speed and the capability and the experience of the other drivers. The judge allowed it in for what it was worth, judge says, you can get it, I'll allow it in for what it may be worth. He said in front of the jury. Of course, the doctors testified as to the injuries, and the hospital records and the bills were introduced into evidence. Then I called the fine boy, who was the young driver, as an adverse party witness. And I put him on the stand, and I said, Mr. Fine, at your deposition, your sworn statement, you showed me your driver's license, and I show you a blow-up of it now. And I had it all blown up on the screen. And I said, please explain the word restricted, which appears in capitals at the bottom of your driver's license.
Lewis,
he says, I'm not allowed to drive at night. I said, but this accident happened after dark at night around 10 p.m., right? He says, yeah, but this was the only time I ever drove at night, and I believe in following the law. I said, did you tell my girls, Gloria and Alice, that you had a restricted driver's license? No. No further questions.
Oh, you got him.
Fast forward to the final argument. The plaintiff gets to speak first, and then again after the defendant's argument, so I get to speak twice.
Good.
When I got up to speak the last time, I pretended to hold a microphone, and I looked right at the jury. I said, ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. It's 10 o'clock in the evening, and we are on the ground at Miami International Airport, and we're about to take off for New York. We will be flying at 30,000 feet. Oh, yes, I forgot to tell you that I'm not allowed to fly this plane at night. I've never flown an airplane at night before. Would you like to get off? I said, well, Gloria and Alice were never given the opportunity to get off, to get out of that car with a driver who never told them that he wasn't allowed to drive at night and had absolutely no experience driving at night.
Great point.
The jury was out. Well, Otis Waters, the attorney for the Smith kid, had his... looking at the floor, and Murray Smith was looking at the floor, and the fine boy was looking down.
Mm-hmm.
So, the jury was out for quite a long time. I went across the street to Sally Russell's bar for a vodka. It took 5 hours. We used to drink vodka so the court wouldn't smell it. Finally, they called me back. We fine for the plaintiffs and award damages of $300,000 to Gloria Berman and $75,000 to Alice Berman. So say we all. Well, the girls were hugging me. Mr. and Mrs. Austin had pushed their way up. This were the parents of the kid that had died.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, I had asked Gloria what those last words of Paul's were, and I knew it was coming. Mr. Ress was so excited and pleased for the Bermans. Mr. Ress, could you please tell us what our son's last words were? I couldn't get myself to sidestep or lie. They were, I can't believe that this is happening to me.
Oh, that's okay. So sad.
Yeah.
And
so,
was he, what, did they give him a sentencing for it? Or, because he's a minor, so it was just...
This was just a civil trial.
Oh, my gosh.
This was just a civil trial for the fine boy. But he was a smart aleck.
So it never went to criminal or anything?
No,
so.
And they never prosecuted him for driving without the license. I'm sure they gave him a ticket of some kind.
Oh,
but it didn't say
gosh.
Anything to do with driving at night for reckless
that
driving.
Poor boy.
So, what do you learn? First of all, you learn about the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes being creative trumps having a knowledge of the law. Of being a theorist, so if you have to be creative, this eccentric T.J. Rance super lawyer, he had closed his mind. He had a superiority complex.
Mm-hmm.
He was never wrong. He was emotionally unstable. He was uninhibited, and he was not a nice person. And a lot of these people are not nice. They're out for themselves. Well, you can imagine.
They just want to make money, yeah.
Well, if you get somebody who's psychiatrically unstable, and I'm not going to say names, but who's crazy and egotistical, they're dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care what they say. They lie, they mm-hmm. cheat, they exaggerate, they distort, and they make up stuff.
They're narcissists. All they care about is themselves. And
that's what the same personality of the super lawyer. They're narcissistic. It's just the point, just the same way. And they have no qualms about lying, telling people I'm the greatest. You know? And the defense lawyer, this guy Otis, people will know who I'm talking about. Somebody's got to represent the KKK in court. They get sued all the time by the Civil Liberties Union or by Southern Poverty Law Center, and they're always being sued. So I started to figure out who was representing the KKK. Well, a lot of them, racist organizations, like Southern Citizens Council, that kind of stuff. Those people have lawyers, and they're usually members. They have the same beliefs. So you'll find that there are a lot of right-wing people, the Nazi Party, the Holocaust deniers, whatever, and they got attorneys. And firms like this represent people like that.
Right.
And that's they click. They get they have a community of beliefs and interests. I looked up who was representing the KKK, and that's interesting too, or the SS of America, you know. And
what's the SS of
America? Yeah, you know, SS troopers, the from the World War II, the Nazi SS.
Oh, wow. The SS, yes, that SS.
These were the guys that were sworn to Hitler to die. They had the tattoo on their arms, SS. Well, the people that represent them are generally people who are members of the organization who happen to be lawyers. They usually come from small towns in Arkansas, Virginia, someplace in the woods. And they come in and defend them.
Are they any good?
No. Not generally, they're not that good.
Yeah, they don't. They probably don't receive the best education.
Well,
or training.
They generally work for nothing, and that's a big factor. And when you get a thing like Southern Law Poverty Center, they're endowed. They have a gorgeous office building. I never realized how much money they had. And they get big endowments, and they get a lot of money.
Well, they're on the right side.
So
so that's good.
Now we're coming to the end of this discussion because we've got to talk about famous last words, because this is last words.
That was very heavy.
So I'm going to give you a whole thing about famous last words. I'll start off with some of them that I know you'll be interested. What was Princess Diana's last words when she was in the automobile accident in the tunnel in Paris?
I don't know.
Nobody knows. I can tell you what they are. She said, "My God, what's happened?" Okay, so similar to the last words, "I can't believe this is happening to me."
Yeah.
My God, what's happened? So there's a similarity. I thought you'd be interested in
that.
Now, you know, the famous, you know, Nathan Hale. Nathan Hale was a spy during the Revolutionary War, and he dressed up as a schoolmaster and went behind the lines into New York when the Continental Army and George Washington were confined in New Jersey and Valley Forge. He was trying to get information on what the British were doing. And I think his brother turned him in.
Oh, gosh.
And and he supposedly said, in the last words, "I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country." That was very patriotic.
Yes.
Actually, I think if you dig enough, you found that he wasn't the first one to use those words. But he was 21 years old and he was hanged.
Oh.
Nobody knows about that either. You know Humphrey Bogart?
I would have probably said something about my brother, too. Well, I was given the opportunity.
Son of a gun. Humphrey Bogart, you know what his famous last
word?
I got one, all these famous last words. There are books written on famous last words. I didn't realize people are interested. I've got a whole bunch of them today. You tell me when to stop. Humphrey Bogart's last words were, "I should never have switched from scotch to martinis." Actually, his wife was confronted with that, and she said, "No." His last words were, "Hurry back, darling. I went out to the store and you left him." And he said, "Hurry." So nobody knows. So what I'm getting at is a lot of these famous last words are not reliable. They made them up. Okay. What are some of the other? You know, Leonardo da Vinci's last words?
What was it?
He said, "I have offended God and mankind because my work did not reach the quality it should have." That's Leonardo. He painted the Mona Lisa. He did the Sistine Chapel, the ceiling. So
Very humble.
That's interesting. Huh? Did you know that Humphrey Bogart had 5-inch elevator shoes?
No.
No.
Wow.
You know what Jack Daniels did? You know Jack Daniels?
Yeah. Whiskey,
He said, "One last drink, please." That's right. Do you know what Beethoven's last words were?
No.
"Friends, applaud. The comedy is over."
Oh, wow. That's a good one.
Do you
like
know
that one.
Bob Marley's last words were?
No.
"Money can't buy life."
Huh. Powerful.
Do you know what Groucho Marx's last words were?
I hope it's a funny one.
He said, "Die, my dear? Why, that's the last thing I'll do." Karl Marx.
Mm-hmm.
Last words are for fools who haven't said enough.
Of course you would say something like that.
Right. John Dillinger, you know, the famous bank robber that uh-huh. the FBI was having, he said, "You got me, copper." Now, you know who James Lawrence was?
No.
James Lawrence was an admiral in the War of 1812, and he was the commander or the captain of the USS Chesapeake.
Hmm.
And they took on a battle off, I think, Boston Harbor with the or New York Harbor with the HMS Shannon, which was a British ship. It was a very big British warship. Well, what happened was the Shannon was a highly trained British crew. You know, they were famous. They were the ruler of the seas.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chesapeake had not trained that much. They were just got the ship and they were young recruits. And they took on this this battle. And Lawrence was beaten. He was wounded. And he was critically wounded. He was dying. And they carried him down below. And he said to the men, "Don't give up the ship."
Hmm.
The first thing they did was surrender.
Oh.
Nobody will tell you. Nobody will tell you that. But the British and the HMS Shannon.
They wouldn't want to end up like you. Surrender.
They finally, they were so impressed that they took pennant, the commissioned pennant of the ship. There's a flag that's called a pennant of the ship. And they returned it to the United States in a ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him full military honors at a funeral.
Wow.
When they took over the other ship. And, of course, Admiral Perry, who did the Battle of Lake Erie, who I'm sure you know about.
No, I don't actually.
I'll give you a lesson in American history. They don't teach history anymore.
I knew about 1812, but that's pretty much the only reference I've known.
Well, Perry took the "Don't Give Up the Ship" motto and had it embroidered on his flag, his personal flag, and flew it in the Battle of 1812 on Lake Erie, and he won that battle.
Okay.
And that was,
so was
very important in the Battle of War of 1812. And so those are the famous last words, except I haven't given you the update. The most famous last words right now that everyone knows are, "I can't breathe." And who said that? You know?
George Floyd.
George Floyd. You're right. And then you had Eric Gardner, who the New York police took out in 2014. And you had Manuel Ellis and Javier Ambler and Elijah McClain and God knows how many, how many times Black Lives Matter, you know, that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all strangleholded.
Yes.
Not so much the knee, but the stranglehold where they grab you and mm-hmm. a lock thing. That's supposed to be illegal now. How many people do you think said, all blacks, "I can't breathe"?
Mm-hmm.
Famous last words. How many? 70.
Wow.
Right. You don't
70?
Hear about it. 70, 7-0.
And those are the ones we know of. Imagine
right.
all the others who
right.
pleaded for their life.
Right. And who weren't recorded or weren't heard.
Exactly.
Exactly so. So I hate to leave the discussion on something so upsetting. But we need to do a lot of reforming of the police department and police methods and treating other human beings in a more humane way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, when somebody says they can't breathe, you don't continue to choke them.
Yeah.
That's murder.
Yes. And, I mean, you shared with us these famous last words from other individuals whose fate wasn't, you know, you can't even compare. A lot of them, you know, passed away in their beds, you know,
right.
things like that. And they have weight. And then for some reason, all these people have been repeating the same thing over and over again within the same circumstance of police brutality
right.
and,
right.
You know, being subjugated to, you know, poor treatment. And yet, what are we doing? You know, what's being done?
Well, what's being done is there's a lot of protesting and a lot of reformation
mm-hmm.
and a lot of re-education. Of course, the present administration stopped a lot of the sensitivity training. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes, it's horrible.
So I have to, when I do a podcast like this, I have to be careful to maintain a neutral or objective position and not offend anybody needlessly. But sometimes the facts sting.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if you believe in alternate facts, then you can create your own facts and tell everybody else that their facts are lies.
Yes.
And that's part of the ego problems that psychopaths have in dealing with people.
Mm-hmm.
You confront them with facts and they say they're untrue and my facts are true and everything else is a lie. And so it becomes a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get into cults, you get into a real problem. One day I'll write a story about cults or a podcast about cults because, and it really, that hurts because that gets into a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, it's a delight speaking with you.
Yes.
And
thank you, Lewis.
I am pleased to do this podcast on Last Words with you. And don't forget to read my book.
Yes.
Now the new one is out called Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. And that's at Amazon.
Perfect. Great. Get your copy, everyone. It's a great read. Very interesting.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see you next time for our next episode. Bye.